Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Say that deep within us, within our DNA, and also our blood crystals are key codes that are waiting to be activated so that we can awaken out of the level of frequency that we have been embedded in for too long. Time to oscillate at a higher vibration. This spontaneous change can occur at any moment based on possibly a synchronistic meeting with someone for the first time and who we find a deep kinship with at a soul level connection, and who passes on important critical information that possibly triggers a unique memory within us or inspires us. Other situations that may occur are the hearing of certain musical notes, or even a whole symphony that stirs us to action, or even the wafting of the fragrance of flowers that gives us cause to take an even deeper breath and that connects us to the core of our being. It brings on an emotional rush, even tears that manage to wash away our fears, our hurt, our losses, that initiates a renewal of our being or a revised perspective of what it is to live. Sometimes looking at mandalas and sacred patterns that we may see in cathedrals, churches, and temples that due to the vibrancy of the colors triggers a response. Reading a book written by a person dedicated to spiritual self-improvement and transformation, and even through ceremony and sacred acts of prayer and meditation, unique responses can make themselves known and calls to us directly. Of course, you just can't sit and lie around and expect things to happen. We do have to make a commitment to want to experience more of the rich tapestry of life. This means being mindful of every action and deed and thought, and we have to be alert and living in the moment, being present and totally open to new experiences. Finding new friends, spending quality time with family, going to different gatherings, joining co-ops, volunteering to assist in community projects, these are all part of connection and becoming whole again. This commitment usually always goes hand in hand in breaking free of old habits that do not serve us anymore. You know what they are. The cleaning up of our diet, the eating of fresh, vital food, preferably organic, drinking the purest water that we can afford, and doing exercises that make us get in touch with our body temple, breathing and sharing breath with the biosphere, and yoga stretches, swimming, walking, tai chi, and gardening. There are many ways to lay the foundations for renewal, especially transformation, and we have to be very discerning and being brutally honest with ourselves, having an open heart, open mind, and realizing that when we commit to a higher ideal, then mysteriously providence will also line up with us too. Remember, the purpose of existence is to find out and realize the purpose of existence. In the studio this morning, I have Jonathan Quinton, who is a cosmologist and an artist, who has dedicated the last 30 years to their study and as an artistic expression of sacred geometry. Kia ora, Jonathan.
Hi, Tim.
Jonathan, good to see you. I was recently at one of your sacred geometry presentations, and it just shows the complexity and magnificence and sheer beauty of how the world is made. But first, Jonathan, what are some of the highlights of your life that has brought you basically the leading edge of geometry, sacred mathematics, and delving deeper into existence?
Highlights of my life? Well, there's been a few, and it goes back a few decades. I spent 5 years living in the Middle East and was just really absolutely in awe of the ancient history there, but most importantly, the beautiful architectures, the pyramids, the temples, the mosques, the synagogues, the Christian churches and cathedrals, all just steeped in sacred geometry. And I felt this really strong connection to it when I started seeing more and more of the geometric symbols and mosaics and architectures, and that I felt very, very drawn to it. And there was a time, actually it was near the beginning, I went there in 1978 when I was 24. I went to work for the United Nations. And here I was in Lebanon, and in the middle of a civil war in Lebanon. I went from Invercargill, from a tiny little, actually, a community south of Invercargill, Awarua Radio, I was working for with the post office, ship-to-shore communication. I went from there to being in war-torn Beirut, working for the United Nations, and my job varied over the 5 years, but in the beginning I went there to establish radio stations in the United Nations field of operations in the Middle East and train the United Nations military, the protocol and the procedure and all of that. And then I'd go to somewhere else and do the same thing over again. But as soon as I got there, I had this really overwhelming urge to visit the pyramids in Giza, the Great Pyramid. It was like this magnet was pulling me there. But in 1978, living in Beirut, it wasn't the easiest thing to get from there to Cairo at that time because, well, as I mentioned, the country was at war, and then there's a hostile border to cross into Israel. Israel and Lebanon were not on very friendly terms, to put it, you know, politely. And then there's another hostile border between Israel and Egypt, not to mention all the desert, the Sinai desert and then the Egyptian desert to traverse. But after a lot of red tape and clearance and maps and visas and all of this, I finally managed to get 3 days and a little bit to go there. And it was a mission. I had a car, I'd commissioned a UN vehicle. And driving from Beirut to Cairo at that time was quite an adventure. I started off at night and I drove down through war zones in Lebanon. I could hear the artillery and gunfire not too far away at different times, and had to cross the border into Israel. And it was quite stringent customs search and really excruciating the amount of detail they go in to make sure that you're not trying to smuggle explosives into Israel. And then driving down through Israel, through the Sinai Desert, of all things, a sandstorm blew up. And I couldn't see. I had zero visibility. And I had to stop, pull over, and wait for the sandstorm to pass over. So I spent the night, or the remaining hours of the night, in the car trying to get some sleep. And finally the sandstorm blew over, and I looked around. And I was surrounded 360 degrees by sand dunes because the sand had blown across the road and I couldn't even see where the road was. And I had no idea what direction to head off in. And I was running out of time. I only had this really small window of time to get to Cairo, get to Giza, and get back again because I had to report for duty. And I thought, wow, not a clue which way to go, let alone where the road was. What am I going to do? What am I to do? It's going to take a miracle in order for me to still make it in time. And probably about, I'd estimate it was like around a minute, maybe 2 minutes, that the miracle took place. And that was the sight of something you would least expect to see in the desert. At least I did. And it was the tip of a ship's funnel gliding through the sand dunes like a shark fin. And I thought, ah, Suez Canal. And that gave me a point of reference. And so then I just had to make my way around the sand dunes towards the ship's funnel, which got me down to the side of the Suez Canal, which had a road running along it. And so I drove along the road until I reached a barge and made the barge crossing to the other side, and At some point I went through the Egyptian customs and all of that, and then drove on through the desert and got into Cairo at dusk, which left me the next day in the morning. I was going to visit the pyramids, and then I'd have to start heading back again. I was so excited. I can't remember ever being as excited. And I didn't get any sleep again. I just laid on the bed just waiting for it to become daylight so I could go there and visit the pyramid. And so at first light I start driving there, and then as I'm driving there I come over a rise, and just below I see the pyramids in the distance, and I just felt every cell of my body was just like, oh, just resonating and titillated, and just this huge state of excitation that finally getting to visit the pyramid, the Great Pyramid. Until I got there to Giza, only to discover that the whole area had been closed off. There was this chain, this human chain of Egyptian soldiers out there with guns out, bayonets fixed, and they seriously were not letting anyone in. And I'd cleared the whole area out of the locals, the Bedouins and the tourists and anyone who had been there, any civilians who had been in the area were cleared away. And all this activity was going on. There were all these jeeps with mounted machine guns driving around. There were helicopters, there were tanks, there were soldiers on motorbikes with machine guns slung over their back. And here I was standing on the other side of the cordon that separated me from getting to the pyramid. And it was like, I can't describe
frustration.
The frustration and the angst and the disappointment and so many things going through my mind. And I thought, well, you know, I've come all this way. I went through all that effort. And if I don't get to see it now, if I don't get up there now, I don't know when I'm going to be able to do it again. And I thought, I just cleared every thought out of my head, and I thought, huh, I'm just going to go. And I thought, what's the worst thing that could happen? Well, you could get shot. There's a few thousand guns out there that could be pointed at you, and, you know. And I thought, well, it's a risk I'm prepared to take. And so I just held in my mind's eye the image of myself up at the entrance of the pyramid, and I cleared everything else out of my mind, and I started circling around the cordon. And the soldiers were almost shoulder to shoulder, but I came across a section where a couple of them sort of drifted apart a few inches, and I just ducked in between them. I didn't look at them, I didn't make any contact of any kind. I just held that image of myself up at the pyramid, and I slipped through this little gap. I had to move sideways to slip through, and no one challenged me, no one stopped me. So I started walking up long winding road that leads up to the pyramids, and the road was lined on both sides by soldiers out, guns out, bayonets fixed. I knew I wasn't invisible because I could see the soldiers looking at me from the sides of their eyes, you know, the corner of their eyes. But also, I assumed, thinking that, well, he's got through, he must have permission. And none of them being willing to
cause a disturbance,
challenge me or cause a disturbance or stick out, yeah. And so I walk up this winding road with his guard of honour. I must have looked so strange because I was wearing jeans and a t-shirt and sneakers, and I had this big black bag of all my camera equipment slung over my shoulders. I looked so out of place, but there I just, you know, kept that image of the entrance of the pyramid in my mind's eye and excluded all other thoughts until I get up to the top there. There's just this hive of activity, and then I hear these sirens, and I look down the road where I just come up. And this convoy was snaking up. It was led by soldiers on motorbikes with machine guns over their backs. More soldiers in jeeps, mounted machine guns, followed by two black stretch limousines, followed by more soldiers in jeeps and more soldiers in motorbikes. and hovering above each limousine with his battleship helicopters, with his huge machine guns out beside, sweeping the area from side to side. And the convoy was coming up and stopped right in front of me. The first black limousine stopped right in front of me. And they opened the right door, and out stepped the Egyptian president at the time, Anwar Sadat. We opened the other door, and out stepped the president of the United States at the time, Jimmy Carter. And I was right there at the entrance, and so they were right in front of me. And in the other limousine was Rosalind Carter and Anwar's wife. And they came and joined us. I say us because I was there and no one said anything. There were a few security guys there, but none of them said anything. I figured that the Egyptians thought I was one of them and the Americans thought I was one of them. And so they, you know, they just politely left me alone, even though I stuck out like a sore thumb because everyone there was wearing either a really sharp suit or a military uniform, except for me, T-shirt and jeans. And so anyway, Anwar starts to give this amazing commentary about the history of the pyramids. He was a scholar and is such an articulate and eloquent speaker and storyteller. And it was mesmerizing. And I was standing shoulder to shoulder with Jimmy. Every now and then we'd look at each other and say, wow, did you hear that? And wow, isn't that amazing? And then after a while, Anwar says, come on, let's go inside. And so I join the entourage and get this presidential tour inside the pyramid. And it's just Anwar and Jimmy and Rosalind and Anwar's wife and me and security guys. And that's it. And we're in there for about 20 minutes. And Jimmy and I had paired up at this time. Wow. And I was having all this, you know, it didn't seem astounding. It just seemed like so familiar to me. I didn't think, wow, you know, here I am, blah, blah. I just thought, yeah, this just seems like I recognize so much of this is what it seemed like. And it seemed like being in the pyramids with the pharaohs. Again, this is the sense I got from it. Whether we're talking about past lives or tapping into a morphogenic field or ancestral cellular memory surfacing to the conscious level of awareness, whatever it is, that's what it felt like. And so we were there for a while, and then we came out, and I wanted to get some photos, so I walked away, some distant photos. I walked away and was taking my photos when I saw Anwar and his wife get into the first limousine. And in order for them to return back down the hill, they had to come and do a U-turn where I was standing. As I'm turning around, Anwar's at the window, back window there, and sees me, and I see him, and I smile at him and wave, and he smiles and lifts his hand and waves with that kind of look on the person's face. Who is that guy? Kind of look. And off they go, and Jimmy and Rosalind are in the next car. And the same thing, and by this time Jimmy and I are mates, and big broad smile, you know, southern smile, and you know, a nice friendly wave. And he waved also to a Bedouin who was happened to be in a gully there. They hadn't moved him out because he was so fragile, so rickety and richety. But Jimmy saw him there and smiled at him and waved to him, and this guy lifts up his craggy hand and smiles a toothless smile and waves at the president of the USA, and off they go. And this party starts breaking up, and I'm thinking, well, I better get going. When this guy in a suit and walkie-talkie and binoculars and all the paraphernalia, a pistol, holstered pistol, walks up to me, and sunglasses, like Men in Black, walks up to me and says, who are you? And I says, I'm Jonathan Quinton. And he says, who are you with? And I says, I'm not with anyone. I'm just here on my own. And he says, "What's in that bag?" And I say, "Well, take a look." And he rumbles through my bag. Fortunately, I didn't have any bombs to take out two presidents that day. Otherwise, I might have been opportunist about it, but I didn't. And then he says, looks at me and he stands back and he says, "How did you get in?" And I found out that day there were 14,000 troops out that day to stop anyone from getting in. And I said, I just walked in. And he looked at me and his jaw dropped. And he says, "Well, I'll be damned." And he walks away shaking his head, just saying, "I'll be damned. I'll be damned." So I didn't have any more time. I had to jump in with the car and then start heading back up to the war in Lebanon. And that was my first visit to the pyramids. And it's relative to my work in geometry because my studies of ancient Egypt and the schools of initiation and how advanced they were in sacred geometry played a pivotal role to bring me to where I am today. And then all the geometries that, you know, I'm bringing through is partly because I've learned things from what they taught.
Well, the pyramids, they still are an anomaly. Really, the academics and the intellectuals of the world do a swerve. They don't really want to study the magnificence of the sheer precision of all this geometry and mathematics. Is that not the case?
Well, because they can't explain. Their version is, you know, rolling over logs and pulling off reed ropes and pulleys and, you know, all of this and all of that. And slaves, of course, and then farmers who, because when the Nile was flooded, then they can't attend their crops. And so instead they build these pyramids with the most amazing accuracy and precision that we can't even equal in the sophisticated technology we have today. We're not able to equal precision that they achieved on that scale.
Yes, when I was there, I had a postage stamp and I endeavoured to put this postage stamp in the gap between the two stone walls, the rock walls of the King's Chamber. And I couldn't do it. And it's like two lots of wallpaper that you see in a living room in a home when they butt up against each other.
Yeah.
That's how close the rocks are.
Yeah, this huge rock and cut amazing precision, yeah. They hoisted them up there in ways that in a time period that is not really physically possible when you work out the map of it, as people have done, like Nassim Harriman.
Yes. In 2004, I heard that the United States had made a crane that could actually lift a 200-ton object.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the first time 21st century man had lifted something greater than was in the Great Pyramid of Cheops. So a huge anomaly, the seventh wonder of the world that still remains here today and still to be decoded.
Yeah.
And then you had to go through this huge trip all the way back home to...
Yep, back again to back into the war and my experiences there. But I spent 5 years there and was stationed, as well as in Lebanon, through Syria and Jordan, Egypt and Israel.
Will there ever be peace there?
Not as long as they continue to encroach on the West Bank.
On the Palestinian West Bank?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Oh, gosh. Yes. Human race.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that has come out of it is that you have taken your knowing of what geometry is, and you've been able to get into something that very few people on Earth are actually looking at, is to see how we're all connected, that there is a matrix of geometric shapes, particular shapes. I mean, we had Plato with his five Platonic solids, but you've taken it far further than this, haven't you?
Yeah, because it's actually limitless, for one thing, and I could live the rest of my life just bringing through new geometries every single day, every single waking moment of my life, and still just be scratching the surface of what's there.
You've been able to use pi and also the golden ratio. You've looked at how the ancients built things, and they had originally, they used a T-square and the compass as means to put the building blocks of temples together, be it the pyramid or anything else. But you have been able to, through computerization, show that there are so many different shapes and how they integrate into each other to connect us into something that is totally whole.
That's right. I think the main thrust, the main message of my work is that there is order to the universe, and this order stands independent of chaos, of space, of time. It even, now this might sound like a bit of a reach for some listeners, but it even stands independent of creation itself. It doesn't even need creation to exist, because what it is, this order, is mathematical principles, pre-existing mathematical principles. They didn't have a beginning. You know, there's no end, because they don't actually, they're not there, except as these invisible principles existing upon the archetypal planes that are the ordering principles of manifestation. And they can be known to us through geometry, because they can be cloaked in geometry. It's basically about relationship. At its most basic level, it's the relationship of number, because number can represent anything, not just quantity. It can represent frequency and angles and angular relationships and coordinates in space and shapes and patterns and forms and smells and sounds and anything that any of our organs of perception can experience can be explained through numbers. And these numbers can be shown in pictures, which is what geometry is. It cloaks these mathematical principles. It gives them form that we can connect with. And so when we do, consciously, visually, mentally, as well as sensually, engage with these geometries, then we open ourselves up to this transcendental order, this cosmos, and of which we are a part of, then we can benefit tremendously, because we contain the same geometric principles within us. We're made of these same geometries that essentially, and without going into too much math, is the golden ratio, and it's other mathematical principles, pi, which you already mentioned, as well as the square root of 2 and the square root of 3. And so the numbers we're looking at, the golden ratio is 1.618, root 2 is 1.414, root 3 is 1.732, and pi is 3.141. And they're all unending ratios. So I just numbered them to three decimal places, but they go unending after that. And these are the main components of the interplay between force and matter. It's the interplay between, because these principles appear in geometry. They appear, first of all, pi is an inherent part of the circle. It's the first relationship that emerges from the void, from source. It's the relationship between the diameter of a circle and its circumference. And if we give the value of, if we give the diameter the value of one unit of measurement, then in ratio to that, in relationship to that, the circumference is 3.141 times longer. And that's the first relationship. And then the first shape to emerge from uniform division of the circle is the equilateral triangle. And that inherently holds the root 3 principle. If we split the equilateral triangle, then it makes two scalene triangles. And if we measure the base of one of those newly formed scalene triangles against the vertical length, it's 1 in ratio to 1.732. Then the other one is in the square. The diagonal of a square is the square root of 2. If we have a square and we give it the value of one unit of measurement, then the diagonal is 1.5. 414 times longer than that. And in the pentagon, the interangular relationship, if you join one angle to its opposite angle in the pentagon, is 1.618 times longer than the edge of a pentagon. So there's a circle in the three primary shapes, the triangle, square, and pentagon. And inherent in each of them are the fundamental ratios of creation. You know, pi, root 2, root 3, and the golden ratio, which mathematically is root 5 plus 1 divided by 2 equals 1.618. Easy to say golden ratio or 5 and all those numbers. So essentially, this is what sacred geometry is about. It's the interplay between the two, because the circle is the void, is the source of undifferentiated potential, of pure potential, from which all the primary shapes and the regular polygons emerge. And another really important thing to include right now about the circle, about the triangles and the squares and the pentagons, is they are two-dimensional representations. The circle is a two-dimensional representation of a sphere, because nature doesn't exist linearly, you know, it's three-dimensional at least to begin with. And so it's like a shadow cast. A circle is like a shadow of a sphere, and a triangle is like a shadow of a tetrahedron. And the square is like a two-dimensional representation of the cube, or hexahedron, as it's called. And the pentagon is a two-dimensional representation of the dodecahedron. So we talk about it and look at it two-dimensionally, but conceptually too, we need to include that other dimensions, more than just three dimensions even. But back to the point I was making, if you think of a square and its diagonal right there, in a nutshell, is what sacred geometry is about, because the shapes represent the physical plane and their inherent root powers that are embedded in these shapes, these mathematical ratios and proportions that we find playing out all over nature through the self-organizing forces of nature, bringing force and matter together, is through the direction of these mathematical ratios, relationships, is what it's all about. And that's one side of it. We find that as the mechanism directing the unfoldment of creation in nature. But it's more than that too. And this is a part that really excites me, is that the creator of the universe used geometry. It's all ordered through geometry and is there out in nature, is apparent to see. But in addition to that, the creator used geometry for artistic expression, because the Islamic mosaics and the mandalas and the geometries that I do, the tessellations, these are pure mathematical principles that always were, always will be. They weren't suddenly created. They didn't one minute not exist and then the next minute they exist as mathematical principles. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't even need creation, let alone space, time, or anything. It's there, and it's there for us to experience through geometry. Sacred geometry is the medium, is the interface, is a portal through which we can engage with this geometry. And as we look upon these geometric shapes and patterns and experience the exquisite beauty and the order, the profound order, how everything comes together, these limitless patterns, be stars and pentagons and triangles and rhomboids and all of these things, thousands, tens of thousands, millions, trillions of them, all organized perfectly around the center of a circle, each one touching the other one, each one connected to every other one in this infinite matrix of stars and squares and triangles and that. As we look at it, then our thought forms, our mental energies are merging with this order, with this transcendental order. We are, it's a union of self and cosmos. We are opening ourselves to the beauty the profound transcendental order of cosmos, of the unified field, and how everything is connected to everything else, and so much more than that. But yeah, maybe ask me some more questions.
I'm speaking with New Zealander Jonathan Quinton on sacred geometry, the makeup of the known universe, and how everything is connected, how everything is whole, and that beneath it all, there is a pattern that is divinely inspired. And the website for you, so to contact?
Is sacredgeometry.com.au. sacredgeometry.com.au.
Well, if I'm out in a snowstorm, every crystal, every snowflake has got a different...
No two the same.
So, yeah. Surrounded. If it's not magic, what is?
Well, see, and what that tells you, too, is infinite possibility. Absolutely. We live in a world of infinite possibility. And because we, as human beings, we have the consciousness that can reflect upon itself. It means that, bringing us back to this geometry that I'm talking about, that's a good case in point. It's only because of our consciousness that we can seek it out, we can work it out. The mathematician, the artist, can bring it into a form, into a medium that can be experienced by an observer, and we can view it and experience it visually and mentally as well. Yeah.
Masaru Emoto, the Japanese scientist who was able to use water crystals based around thought, positive thoughts and negative thoughts, proves that if we put out good thoughts, we do get a very magnificent crystal. And if we put out negative thoughts, we get a very dark, convoluted crystal. So that, again, is a good signal for us. Whatever we think can materialize.
And it works both ways, too. When we put out good thoughts, we create good geometries in water. If we engage with good geometries there, then it's going to impact on us also in a positive way. And so Emoto's way is, you know, we are creating the geometry, and the other way is we look at already celestial, or it's already created, it's celestial geometry, it's from the hand of the creator. If we look at that, then it benefits us enormously, because as I mentioned earlier, we contain the same geometry within us, and so it's opening us more to of who we are, and importantly of who we can be. Sacred geometry, depending upon a number of variables such as the viewer, who they are, their consciousness, their intention, their level of consciousness, their experience, their abilities, the geometries can be very psycho-spiritually active and can stimulate neural pathways of the brain and connect different parts of the brain and access more parts of the brain and beyond the brain. And also importantly, it helps to integrate the left and right hemispheres of the brain, because it uses both simultaneously. And your left brain is working out, it's the analytical, rational, logical understanding of it, whereas the right brain is required because of the beauty and the profound implications of it. And they're working together. When the left brain and right brain are working together in alignment, there's a synergy. There can be the synergy where you merge into whole brain consciousness and expanded awareness. And that's the whole thrust of my work, is that it provides the material for the people who want to do this. It provides the geometries, the frequencies, the harmonic frequencies that are embedded in these archetypal geometric patterns and formations.
Well, a sphere is round. If you have all the planets going around our sun, each planet is spinning at a different speed. And as it spins, each harmonic of sound that comes off it is a different note. Just like when we were kids, we used to have tops that used to spin, and they used to hum and put out their own musical note, charging us, or they're giving us something else, because they're part of this whole as well, are they not?
We all are. Everything is. And Pythagoras referred to that as music of the spheres. You could actually hear the sounds because they're like, you know, instruments.
That's right. They're instruments. I think that's the word I was wanting.
Yeah. And the celestial orchestra. And then, you know, they play their music, their symphony, their celestial symphony. And we are affected by it.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Because if you have a look at the Earth and have a look at all the rock strata into the so-called gemstones and crystals, and have a look at each particular crystal, be it a ruby or a diamond, you'll find that there is a specific geometrical shape.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, as I said earlier, the creator, the grand architect of the universe, uses geometry, mathematics and geometry, for it all to manifest.
So getting back to water, if we drink water, but if we either bless it or hold our hands over it and see it as light, goodwill, love, and we drink it, it will actually, our soul, our spiritual body will say, yes, this is what I've been wanting, as you drink this pure water down into your system, because that's the closest thing that we can actually do at a physical plane level to affiliate with our soul is to drink pure water. I guess this is where baptism comes into it as well.
And then with consciousness, yeah, because we are, you know, 70% thereabouts water. And our planet is, you know, a lot of water. And it is, it holds, it imprints, it carries the imprint. And if we're holding that thought with pure water, it's easier to take on board, so to speak.
Jonathan, you go around the world, you do video presentations to very distinguished audiences. And could you just explain a little to the listeners what you do?
Well, it's sort of a beginner's guide to the universe. And I show in very simple terms, because I'm not a mathematician. I'm an accidental mathematician. It was 30 years ago that I even gave myself permission to be an artist. And of course, I wanted to do the art about geometry and sacred geometry. I had to learn the math along the way. I didn't learn it in school. I failed every math paper I ever sat in school.
Me too.
Yeah, and I learned it because I had to. It was a field that I was interested in, and I worked it out.
Yes, interesting, because there was a TV program recently, a Seattle man in the States called Jason Padgett, who was injured by some hoodlums who beat him up trying to steal his jacket. And when he came to, he saw the world in a different way. And he saw it in geometrical context. He would see a water fountain, and the water fountain looked like it was actually pushing out cubes, transparent cubes. And when he looked at the water going down the plug hole, the sort of concentric circles, etc.,
I saw the Pythagorean theorem, yeah. So, yeah. I saw that video that you sent me.
And so what it is we need to see if we can broaden this. Within the human condition, well, we've been conditioned to become gods of limitation, when in actual fact we should be gods, we're embryonic gods, ready to expand and grow and realize our spiritual inheritance. And that this person is classified now as a savant, and he's able to do these many complicated programs or complicated problems and solve them. What do you feel is inherent in the human being, and how can we use sacred geometry to really look within and also expand our worldview?
When you're talking about that man in Seattle, I think you wanted me to talk about what happened to me as well.
Yeah,
because I also had a head injury. I wasn't beaten up, thank God. By the universe.
We nailed him.
Yeah. Carry on. Would you like me to speak about that?
Oh, just quickly, because it was quite interesting, because you saw it coming at one level and you took it on the forehead.
Yeah, I had this freak accident where I struck between the eyes by a rock. And shortly after that, I had this epiphany into this field of geometry, this field of pentagonal, decagonal, golden ratio geometry. And that was years ago, and it's carried on since that time. I've had this really deep, comprehensive understanding of geometry as a result of that accident, and talking about potential. That is an integral part of my work, is to help people tap their, activate more of their potential, because I believe we all have, well, we all have super consciousness and have had since the time of conception, when we orchestrated from two cells, from our mother and father, from that point, we orchestrated trillions of cells working in unison together. We had this information in us, this knowledge in us. We didn't access it externally. It was internalized. It's like Rumi says, you are both a drop in the ocean as well as the ocean in the drop. And it's the same thing as saying we're a holograph of a fractal universe. We contain the universe within us. We contain all the information, all the wisdom, all the knowledge of the universe within us, just as each drop of the ocean contains the essence of the entire ocean within it. And geometry can help us access more of that. It's like we have these mechanisms, these safety mechanisms in place. We'd have to, or we'd go mad, our mind, brain would explode. So these mechanisms, but geometry can work it in a way that you can access usable amounts of brilliance. And we all have it, and I want to help people access more of who they are and who they can be.
For the sake of our listeners, you have mentioned the Creator a number of times, the word Creator.
Yeah.
And also there's evolutionary forces driving the system as well.
Yeah.
Can you just paint a little picture for it?
When I say Creator, okay, so I'm not religious at all. I mean, I was raised in the Irish Catholic Church, and I left the day I turned 16 when I was no longer forced to go, and I consider myself as a survivor of Catholicism. Yeah, so religion does not factor into my concept of reality, other than, as you know,
spirituality
and comfort and companionship,
mm-hmm.
and helping. And in terms of the universe and creation, no, I don't think any religion can do that, because my view is that unless a religion is totally 100% all-inclusive of all living beings, which none are, then
Separation.
And my understanding of creation is inclusion in everything. And so I see geometry, you know, holds that. And I think of the Creator, I don't think of a necessarily as a being. I think, you know, it's creation itself. The Creator is creation itself, is the universe, is nature. If we were to try and define it, I would say it's nature.
Well, the Chinese never could define it, and they called it Tao, or the Way.
Yeah.
And they just get in the flow, and we have to just become coherent with the flow of nature, and Taoism does actually bring that to the fore, doesn't it?
And I think there's more, too, because the geometries, the artistic, the mosaics and the tessellations in there, amazing, incredible, purposefully, intelligently ordered. They don't happen. They doesn't happen through randomization or anything like that. They're very intentionally, purposefully designed that way. And it's brilliant. It's beyond brilliant. It's beyond the capabilities of the human mind to orchestrate anything in that way. And infinite as it is. So more than just nature, there's something there that includes beauty and a yearning to express beauty and articulate this beauty through geometry, not just in nature, but in mathematics as well, that I do in my drawings.
There's an old saying, in the beginning was the word, so it starts off with a vibration, and the vibration vibrates more and more and more until it gives light, and then something else happens. I mean, there are these what we call universal archetypes.
Yeah.
And geometry is a universal archetype, but you're also saying that it's possibly pre-universe. This archetype is still there because the concept.
Because it doesn't need anything. It doesn't even need creation to exist as principles, as mathematical principles. And everything is vibration, is frequency. Vibration, you know, can be described as frequency, can be measured as number. And number can be organized into shapes and patterns and forms was his geometry.
Well, Sir James Jeans, the great mathematician of the 20th century, he said if the universe is one great big thought.
Yeah, the support form of God. If we're going to use that terminology, you have to be careful using that terminology, but, you know, religious people like to kind of save it for themselves.
That's right, they've got a mortgage on God. Yeah. Really quite interesting. Yeah. And Sir James Jeans, the great physicist in the last century, also, he said the stuff of the universe is mind stuff, and this is where we need to be open. Totally open.
Well, you know, the geometry of divinity, what's its acronym? I mean, you know, what's its G-O-D, geometry of divinity.
Oh, okay. That gets the picture home. And Jonathan, do the academics and the people in the higher schools of learning, how do they relate to what you are offering up?
Well, mixed results, but math is math. Can't say that it's not happening. It's there. It's verifiable. It's there as math. But the part of projecting it out into nature, of reflecting it into nature, because nature is imperfect, they say, oh, you know, they use that as reason not to believe it, because it's not clearly apparent. If you look at it already deciding that it's not there, you're not going to see it. If you look at it with an open mind, if you look at it believing it will be there, you'll see it. If you look at it believing it won't be there, you won't see it. If you look at it with an open mind, you will discover it.
So when you look into a sunflower, you see the geometry in the sunflower. You pick up a pine cone, you see the geometry in a pine cone, and you can even see it in the, how it works out, yes, in the shape of a hand. It's basically in our faces.
It's in front of your face, yeah.
Yeah, wild. It's, yeah, profound. So, Jonathan, how would you like to see things unfold for you and for your relationship with the human race?
Well, I want to reach as many people as I can with geometry, because I think it can help set them free. And so I'm using every medium available to me. And my new DVD, that's my latest efforts to contribute something to humanity.
And the website for you, so to contact?
Is sacredgeometry.com.au. So I've just finished just this latest one with my latest work, and then the geometries, I've been sitting on them for a decade or so, thinking about them, and suddenly it just came through, just like this force, this...
inspiration, intuition, everything.
Yeah.
As one.
As one. It came through, and I worked around the clock for hundreds and hundreds of hours, and finally got it together. So visit the site, I've got a link to examples of it.
And many other people too who are doing in this scene?
Yeah, I'm going to visit Nissim after here. I'm going to visit him, and we co-present together and on the unified field. Him from the perspective of physics and me from metaphysics, and it's a beautiful complementation.
Excellent. Well, I thank you very much, Jonathan, for wanting to cleave through reality and open it all up so that we can, en masse, wake up.
Yeah. Been a pleasure, Tim.
Thank you. That was New Zealander Jonathan Quinton talking about the hidden qualities of how our universe works. And when you go into and have a look at a site and get the understanding of what it is, it can open you up to new possibilities, new understandings, and allow you to take another step inward. At the end of this interview, Jonathan also mentioned a person called Nassim Hariman, Haramein, and his home site is resonance.is, resonance.is, and he integrates his information so well with Jonathan that they are at the leading edge of mystical science globally. I would like to draw your attention to the Green Planet Earth Files. This is a section of this program that covers points of interest that you, as listeners, can become involved. This way, the Green Planet program can facilitate positive options to bring about reducing our ecological footprint, acting in truly sustainable ways, and work towards becoming more carbon neutral. Earth Files for this week. Just a gentle reminder, New Zealand is having its election on the 20th of September of this year. And the challenge for New Zealanders is to get out and vote. Since the first election in 1853, New Zealand has been a world leader in voting rights. All Maori men were able to vote from 1867 and all European men from 1879. Then in 1893, New Zealand famously led the world by giving women the right to vote. Thus it was the first country to give indigenous peoples a vote, as well as all women. New Zealand was probably the most democratic country in the world. Cut to today and we have lost our way. The global malaise of a dumbed-down society has burrowed its way into the lobotomized minds of our once cherished egalitarian New Zealand society. How can we inspire people to be involved in their community at a local level? Very interesting. In New Zealand Herald, on the 8th of September, there was a cartoon. It was called Bodhi's View. In this cartoon, there was a large, dark mountain with a big stone door. Over above the door, it had youth vote, and in brackets, beware. Walking past in front of this doorway were two knights in armor on horseback, and their shields were that of the National Party, which is the governing political party here in New Zealand at the moment. One of the knights turned round and said, "Psst, Sir Key, what do we do if a giant awakes?" And Sir Key, meaning John Key, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, says, "Just pray that it's too busy watching pussycats on YouTube." And this is the challenge we've got at the moment. We have so many young people who are totally unaffiliated to what's going on in the world. They have, for some unknown reason, turned off, and this appears to be a global malaise of not being engaged or connected to what is happening in the world today. And if you cast your vision into the future, in 10 or 15 years' time, these young people will be enraged because they will realize that the adults and the baby boomers, my generation, within the political, the business and civil society, did not raise the alarm seriously enough to want to take care of all children and grandchildren's collective future. This is heartbreaking. So encourage all youth at this coming election to get out and vote. That is Earth Files for this week. You can listen to this program on planetaudio.org.nz for the next 7 days, or better still, for iPod and stream. It can be obtained 6 hours after broadcast on greenplanetfm.com, holisticliving.co/greenplanet, and you can follow Green Planet FM on facebook.com/greenplanetfm. Come and like us. We like being liked. This is Tim Lynch and the spirit of Aroha.